Good morning. Our scripture is from Ruth 4, 1 through 12, the English Standard Version. Now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there. And behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, "Turn aside, friend. Sit down here." And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. Then he said to the Redeemer, "Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative, Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you." And he said, "I will redeem it." Then Boaz said, "The day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you will also acquire Ruth, the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance." Then the Redeemer said, "I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it." Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other. And this was a manner of attesting in Israel. So when the Redeemer said to Boaz, "Buy it for yourself," he drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses this day that I have bought from the land of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and to Mahlon. Also, Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day." Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make this woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem, and may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman." This is God's holy word. You may be seated.
Thanks, Kevin. Morning, church. I know Jared appreciates the opportunity that you guys give him to kind of focus the past couple weeks here at seminary as he's working, finishing up his doctoral program. And I appreciate the opportunity to be able to stand up here. I also appreciate the fact that people showed up when they knew ahead of time that I was going to be here. So appreciate that. We are in Ruth chapter 4 this morning. You know, we say this a lot here, that when we gather together, we are about reading the Bible, singing the Bible, praying the Bible, preaching the Bible, and there's a reason for that. It's because we believe that in the Bible we have the words of truth, we have the words of the gospel of Jesus Christ, we have the words that give life. And as we've been going through this series for the past, I think, 7 weeks now, and we'll be closing out the book of Ruth next week. We've seen that. We've seen God at work in his word. And I encourage you to continue to do that. It's so easy. It's easy for me as we read through a historical book to focus on the historical aspects of it, what's going on. And it's easy for me at times to not always remember and look for those places where we are seeing God at work. I mean, it's easy in some passages where we see God is saying this, talking to this person, is directly in the words. It's a little harder when we're looking at texts like this where the characters are playing out what's going on, and you don't see God, say, personally up front in the text. But he's there, and he's been there. We've seen him at work. We've seen his providence, his sovereignty, in what's going on with Ruth and Boaz, and we're going to continue to see that today. And I titled the the message today is redeeming a name. And I think what we're going to see here in the text, and this is really kind of the climax of the book, of everything that we've been working up to, today is the day that we see Boaz going and doing what we've seen the last couple chapters leading up to redeem Ruth, to redeem, you know, be that kinsman redeemer. And so there's some legal aspects to it that we'll see as we go through the passage. But it's all leading up to this. And we've seen God coordinating things in Naomi's life, in Ruth's life, and coming just happened to come upon Boaz's field. He's there. He's working in here. But the reason I chose the term or the title, redeeming a name, is because that's what we're seeing. And as Kevin was just mentioning as he read through the passage, is that there's a name that's threatened to be ending, and that's Elimelech's clan. You know the story through the first couple of chapters where Naomi and Elimelech, who live there in Bethlehem, and there's a famine in the land, so they go to Moab. Then there's two sons that they have, Mahlon and Chilion. They take Moabite wives. Then Elimelech dies, and so Naomi is a widow, and then her two sons die. And so now there's no one to carry on the name, and that's the name that's in danger here of passing away and not continuing. And the name was important in Israel, and we'll see that play out even more so, and that's one of the driving forces behind what Boaz is doing here. But I want you to also think about just this idea of what's in a name, the importance that we place on names of things. And you think about in marketing, you know, everyone's about their brand. And when certain names of products or services come up, there's something that comes to our mind. You know, maybe it's, are you Coke or are you Pepsi? You know, and you might have a favorite one or the other. Is it Mac or Apple or Windows? You know, certain things come to mind. Is brand, just brand names versus generic names. There's just kind of this initial thought, okay, a brand name is better. You know, it's tried, it's true, it's a common name for a reason, because people like it. There's something behind that. We do the same thing with family names. I'm Ivy Lee Boswell III. I was named, obviously, then after my father and after my grandfather. And when Wendy and I got married and began to have children, we had four biological before we took on doing fostering and adopting. We had four biological children. Our first one was Lee, my oldest. He's Ivy Lee Boswell IV. Yes, I did that to him. So he had my name, but he also had his grandfather's name. And then Kaylin was born, and her middle name is Lois, and that's named after Wendy's mom. So Ivy Lee Boswell, Kaylin Lois Boswell, and then Ian was born, and his middle name is Matthew. Matthew spelled with one T. Why? Because Wendy's dad's name is Matthew, spelled with one T. It's a family name. And then when Isaac was born, the only grandparent left was my mother. And my mother's name is Dorothy. And no, we didn't name him Isaac Dorothy Boswell. Because we're not that mean. But her middle name is Jean, J-E-A-N. And so we changed it to G-E-N-E. And so he's Isaac Jean. And so all four of our first four children have that name. We carried on the family name in their name because it was important for us to recognize them and to show the importance and the worth of it. And so we're going to see that throughout here, the importance of a name, both the importance of the name that's being preserved for a prophetic purpose that Jared will be talking about even more next week, but also what's in the name of the people that are involved in our text. And over the past several weeks, Jared has made mention to what the different people's names mean, what Naomi's name mean, that it was her name means pleasant. But remember, when she came back after 10 years of famine and entered back into Jerusalem, and the women of the city saw her, and she said what? Call me Mara, which means bitter, because of what she had gone through. So we've seen the importance of different names. Boaz means in him is strength, and that's certainly characteristic of what we've seen of Boaz and his character. And another thing that we've seen about these two primary people of Ruth and Boaz in this text is they're both considered worthy. They're godly people. We've seen it played out in their the things that Boaz has done, in the way that he's taken care of Ruth and her mother-in-law, Naomi. And we'll continue to see that today. So we're here in chapter 4, verse 1. Picks up with, now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there. And really now it could probably better be used just the word and. Because it's really just picking up what we saw last week. If you look back in the text here, back in chapter 3, you remember last week as we went through all of that initial chapter there, that it ended after Naomi had told Ruth to go to the threshing floor. It was the end of the harvest time. Their threshing was taking place. And Naomi had told Ruth to go to the threshing floor, wait till everything was done, wait till they had eaten and had lied down, and then go to Boaz, or go to Boaz and lay at his feet. We saw that in the course of that evening, Ruth actually proposes or asks for a proposal for Boaz to marry her. And it was at that time that our story had that plot twist that came up where Boaz said, I would redeem you, but there's one that's a closer relative. And so we have to deal with him. I have to go and speak to him. And so if you look back in chapter 3, back in verse 15, as the morning was coming in to a new day, verse 15, Boaz says to Ruth, bring the garment you are wearing and hold it out. So she held it out, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went into the city. And the rest, 16 through 18 there, is kind of like a parenthesis of what happened when she went into the city. But you could almost just read as far as what's taking place, what's the progress of what's going on. If you just read the end of verse 16 right into chapter 4, then she went into the city and Boaz had gone up to the gate. Okay, he's doing this immediately. He's not wasting any time. He said, I will do all that you ask. And the character of Boaz and what we know about him, that's exactly what he's doing. He's not wasting any time, but he's going to go and do what he said he was going to do. And so he's a man of his word. He goes up to the gate and he sits down there. And something we have to remember, you know, with the culture differences, what does it mean by the gate? It wasn't just some place insignificant. This is where transactions took place. There was a lot going on at the city gates. This was a place where people would come in if they lived in the farming areas around. But anytime they would come into the city, they would have to go through that gate. And there were actually little shelters. Didn't necessarily have walls around it, but there would be some places that had some roofs there where transactions would be taking place. So people would be there. You would have men of the city, that referred to here in our text as elders of the city, that would witness what was taking place, transactions, selling and buying of different things. And you would have people just hanging out around there. And so we see all of that going on in, at this time period, at the beginning of the day, as he goes up to the gate and he sits there and he waits. And then the text says, and behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. And it would be easy for us to just read that quickly and move on and miss what's taking place. The text doesn't say, and the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. It says, and behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken. Because the author wants us to see that God's at work here. God, in his providence, is directing this time. Now, would it be unusual for this Redeemer to come in through the gate? Not necessarily. But the author wants us to know that there's a timing involved in here. Just as we saw back in chapter 2, where it said that Ruth just happened to come along the field of Boaz. Now here, Boaz goes up to the city, and he sits down, and behold. And it almost has this idea of he wasn't waiting there for hours either. He came to the city gates, he sat down, and behold, the man comes up. The Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. And he says to him, the second half of verse 1, Boaz says, turn aside, friend, sit down here. And he turned aside and he sat down. And it's interesting that our text uses that word there, just of calling him a friend. Turn aside, friend. And because the words behind that is quite ambiguous, or, well, it's purposeful, but it's there's a reason why they use a word instead of friend. It's kind of a Hebrew idiom. It's kind of like saying Mr. So-and-so. Hey, you, come here and sit down. But it's not because Boaz didn't know who he was, because we know that Boaz knew who he was, because he referred to him in chapter 3 to Ruth, saying, hey, there's one that's a closer relative. So he knows who he is. But the narrator, the author of the book of Ruth, purposely is not giving the name out. So did Boaz really say, hey, Fred, come over here and sit down? Maybe he did. But the author here is saying, Mr. So-and-so, come here and sit down. And there's purpose behind that. What he's saying is, I'm not even going to bother giving you his name. And in a book where we're talking about how important names are, and we're giving the name of Boaz, in him is strength, and yet this man that comes by, the Redeemer, we don't even know his name. We don't even give his name. It's not because Boaz doesn't know it. It's not because the author of the book doesn't know it. They're purposely going out of the way not to give his name, which makes us wonder, why would they do that? It wouldn't be a good answer just to say, well, it's not important. This is pretty important. He's the close redeemer for Naomi and for Ruth. So it's important. But yet, all we see is Mr. So-and-so. It's either unnecessary or it's undesirable to give his name here. And I think that it's not that it's unnecessary. I think what we see as we learn about this particular man, that there comes a clear reason why we just refer to him as Mr. So-and-so. The Hebrew words there is actually Poloni Almoni. So we can call him Mr. Poloni for the rest of the message here. Mr. Poloni. So Boaz says, turn aside, Mr. Poloni here, sit down. And he turned aside and he sat down. Verse 2 tells us that he also took two men of the elders of the city and said, sit down here, and that they sat down. And so what Boaz is doing is he's convening a meeting here, an official transaction, an official meeting that he wants to conduct some business. So what he's doing is not just simply saying, hey, you know, there's another relative here who's closer than me. Let me give him a call. Let me see if, you know, tell him what's going on here. See if he wants to stand up and do what's right. He knows that there's an official way to do this. He knows that there's some legal aspects to this. And so he's calling the elders of the city together. Later on, 10 becomes kind of the requirement for a quorum, not at this time, so it's kind of a predecessor to that. But it's important to bring in people, enough people of the elders who can bear witness to what's taking place here. And so he does that. He gets all the people, all the players are now together. It's him, it's Mr. Poloni, it's the 10 elders of the city, and then he can begin to speak about this transaction. And that's where we pick up in verse 3. Then he said to the Redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one beside you to redeem it, and I come after you. And so he lays out the circumstance here. He says, Naomi has come back and he's selling a parcel of land. Now, does that throw anyone else for a loop there? It's like, what have we been building up to for the past three chapters? When have we ever mentioned anything else with land? It's never come up. It was always about Ruth. It was, remember back in the earlier chapters, it was even Naomi saying to her mother, saying to Ruth there in chapter 3, verse 1, my daughter, should I not seek rest for you that it may be well with you? She was wanting to make sure Ruth got provided for. So it was always seemed to be focusing on the relationship, on making sure that Ruth would be remarried and that she would be able to have children and continue on the name and the family of Elimelech. But yet, that's not where Boaz starts. He doesn't say, hey, there's Ruth here. Instead, he says, there's land. Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land. Will you buy it? And so the first thing that we have to understand, if we're going to try to answer, well, why does he bring up the land and not bring up about Ruth? Which, as you heard from the text, he does afterwards. Is he just being shrewd and kind of starting off with the land? Let's kind of get a feel for, you know, Mr. Poloni here, if he's even interested in it, before we bring in Ruth. I think there's a better answer than that. And part of it is helping us to understand how land really plays a part in this. If you remember back, before the time of the Judges, which is the time period that Ruth is written in, back before that, we have Joshua bringing the nation of Israel into the promised land. And when they brought them into the promised land and they go through and they have the central and the southern and the northern campaigns of taking over the land, wiping out some of the Canaanites. And after that, what happens? The end of the book of Joshua, you see the dividing of the land, where they divide up the land of Israel into the 12 tribes. And then within each tribe, they divided up the land among the different clans. And the land was divided up and given to families for all time. In fact, if we look back, you don't have to turn there right now, but in the book of Leviticus, chapter 25, where it begins to talk about the redemption or redeeming property, which we'll get to in a moment, it starts out saying in verse 23, "The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. You are strangers and sojourners with me. And in all the country you possess, you shall allow a redemption of the land." So what God told the people of Israel from the very beginning is, I'm bringing you into this land, but it's my land. And I'm dividing it up and I'm giving it to you, but it's still my land. And as they divided it up to different tribes and then different clans, a piece of property was maintained within a particular family for all time. So if I were to begin to have trouble with money, I couldn't afford the land anymore, and I would go and I would sell the land, I wasn't actually giving them the title of the land. It wasn't their land for good now, not as a way that we would sell things today. But instead, what would take place is I would sell the rights to use the land for a certain amount of time. And so if I needed money, I couldn't work the land, or I needed to pay things, I would sell a portion of the land, not the title, but the rights to use the land, so that I would have the money to pay what I needed to pay. And then at some later time, if I had the money again, I could buy back the land, buy back the right to use my land again. Okay? If that couldn't happen, if it got to the point where I still couldn't afford it, God had worked into his law the year of Jubilee. Now you remember there, as God laid out the law to the people, he gave them different feasts and festivals, different times of years where they would rest, they would have Sabbath years, but then they had the year of Jubilee. Every 50 years was a Jubilee year. And God provisioned in his law that if somebody had sold the rights to use their land, that in the year of Jubilee, that land would return back to the original owner. So if I had a piece of land and I sold the rights to it, say, 5 years before the year of Jubilee, then they could use that land unless I come back and I redeem it, I buy it back, or come the year of Jubilee, that land would return back to me. Now, there are different provisions of what you did for somebody that had been occupying that land and using it for a while. But what we're seeing there is that the land always remained with the people. And so that's part of what's going on here, is you have Naomi who has this parcel of land that's really the land of Elimelech, because in the culture there, it was the men that had the title to the property. So even though Elimelech had died and the sons had died, the text here is saying Naomi has that land because most believe that she would have the ability to do what she wanted with that land until she passed away. If she passed away and knowing that there were no sons after it, then what would happen is that land would go back to the people, the clans themselves. It would revert back because there's nobody else, no sons to carry on the name of the land. But it would still stay within the clans of Elimelech. So the land always stayed within the family. So here, Naomi, because of her hardship, some say it was because Elimelech may have sold a part of the land when there was the famine and they had left for Moab, and that what he's actually referring to is that she was trying to buy that back. But it seems more clearly that she's actually trying to sell the rights to it, that they came back from the famine when the famine was over, but yet they couldn't work it. Remember, it was already past the planting season. They were harvesting when they came back, so she couldn't actually work the land. She didn't have a means to do that. She didn't have the money to do that, so now she's probably selling a portion of this land, if not all of it, selling the parcel of land. And rather than allowing that to just go into somebody else's name, Boaz is saying, as a redeemer, you have the option and even the right to purchase that land. And the answer that we see there in the text, when Boaz says, redeem it for yourself, if not, I'm the only other one that comes after you, I will redeem it. But we see at the end of verse 4 that Mr. Poloni says, I will redeem it. Which for those looking through the story of Ruth and Boaz, and things seem to be going really well, and then there's the kind of the monkey wrench comes in where there's another redeemer. Well, now not only is there another redeemer, but then the other redeemer is willing to redeem the property for himself. Seems like things are not going well. But as we know through the rest of the text, God is still sovereign. God works it out for him, for his will and his purpose. But he says that he will redeem it. So not only do we need to, first of all, understand a little bit about the land situation and how land works in Israel, but we also need to understand a little bit more about this redeemer. When we talk about the kinsman redeemer, is the term used in the past couple of chapters. It's just a single word in Hebrew that refers to the closest relative who has this ability and has this right to redeem several different things. The first thing, as we've been looking at, he has that right to redeem land. Secondly, he has the right to redeem a name. If we turn back over here to Leviticus chapter 25 for a moment. In Leviticus 25, beginning in verse 23 that I read a moment ago and continuing down through verse, say, 28, first we saw that if a man is poor and he sells part of the property, the nearest relative can buy that back. Later in verse 35, we see that if a brother becomes poor and can't maintain himself, that he can kind of sell off himself to pay for things that he has. But then also in Deuteronomy chapter 25, we read that the redeemer has another right, another option, and that is to redeem someone who, in this case, fits the scenario of what's taking place with Ruth. In Deuteronomy 25, it's called a Levirate marriage. In chapter 25, verse 5, he says, if brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Instead, her husband's brother shall go into her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of the dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. And so a redeemer can redeem land, but he's also there to redeem or to continue on a family name, a family line. It's the other piece. Now, there's a third piece, and that is to act as an avenger. If a family member is killed, then the kinsman redeemer can act as an avenger toward the one who committed the murder. That's not at play here in our text. But we do have the two other ones in play. Redeeming land and redeeming a name, redeeming the purpose, the person, because we have that scenario where Naomi is now a widow and she has no sons to continue on. And so in order for her name to continue, there must be a redemption that takes place. And so this nearest kinsman, redeemer, has the ability to do that, to come in and redeem the land since there's no one else to carry on. Now, in the case of Naomi, she's actually past childbearing age. So there's not a situation where he would be redeeming Naomi for the purpose of having more sons. Remember, even Naomi kind of joked at the beginning in chapter 1 with Ruth and Orpah about that. Are you going to wait around till I have more children and that they get old enough to where you'd marry them? It was ridiculous to even think of. She's past the age of bearing children. And so it looks initially like that's not part of what's taking place, that it's only the parcel of land that's come into play. But then Boaz continues. In verse 5, he says, "Then Boaz said, 'The day that you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance.'" So now Boaz is bringing in Ruth. First, it was just about the land, because the land was at play here. But secondly, now it's Ruth. Not only are you to redeem the land, which that sounds pretty good. I mean, you think when the redeemer says, "I'll redeem it," well, what's the benefit for him? Well, he gets land. You see, if nobody redeemed it at all, then it would just go back and be dispersed among the clan of Elimelech. But if the redeemer, as one from the clan of Elimelech, if he were to purchase the land, then it would be his. Even at the year of Jubilee, it wouldn't go back to where it came from, because there's no one to go on. There's no sons of Elimelech that would acquire the land back. So the redeemer, Mr. Poloni, would have the land. So there was great benefit for that. But now Boaz introduces that it's also Ruth. And that's important. That's why we see both of these in play in the text, is because it's not just land, but there is a daughter-in-law. And Boaz is saying, if you don't redeem Ruth as well, then I will, for the purpose of perpetuating the name. In other words, so that the name of Elimelech will continue on. Well, now what's the scenario for the redeemer? Well, if he were to buy the land, first of all, he should also then redeem Ruth. It's the right thing to do. But what we have to understand, too, is that it's not required. Remember if you heard me read the text from the book of Leviticus, it talks about the brother. It talks about the close family that is the one to redeem. Now, they're close relatives, but they're not required. They're not commanded to redeem it, which is why Boaz gave him the right to, hey, if you'll do it, fine. If not, I will. Okay? The redeemer didn't have to redeem, but he had the option to do it. And I think what we see from the law is that it would be the right thing to do. And in fact, that's what Boaz was saying that he would do. I'll do the right thing. I'll do what is right. And I'll redeem it if you won't. Boaz says, "The day that you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth." Why? It's not that that Ruth came with the land. It's that Ruth was from Naomi, from the family of Elimelech, and so the land is tied to the name. She's tied to the name, so both come as a package. Both, you can't, even though he could probably legally buy the land and not acquire Ruth, that wouldn't be the right thing to do. And what is his answer? In verse 6, he says, "The redeemer said, 'I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption for yourself, for I cannot redeem it.'" He was willing to do it when it was land and it was benefit for himself. But now he says, "But I can't do it. I can't redeem Ruth, because that's going to impair my own inheritance." In what way? How is this bad for his inheritance? There's a couple possibilities of what he means by that. It could be, and most likely what it's talking about, is that he probably has other children from one or otherwise. And so now adding Ruth in as a wife, who we know from the text intends to have children, well, now that means there's more offspring. So when it comes time for the Redeemer to divvy up, divide up his land, his inheritance to those people, now there's more to have to divide it among. So even though he would be gaining some land, he's going to have to take all of his possessions and divide it up into all of the children that he has and the children that he would then have through Ruth. And that means each of his children would probably get less. And so maybe in that way, it's impairing. Also, what's probably into play is he was willing to acquire the land, which meant also caring for Naomi. So there was some expense there. But now, if he's also going to take Ruth as his wife and then have children, there's going to be more expense in caring and providing for Ruth in addition to Naomi. And so he could be also referring to that. It's going to impair my inheritance if I have to now start caring for these people. You start to see the character of this person, of the Redeemer. You start to understand maybe why the author doesn't even want to name him. He's not even worthy to give his name because he's not willing to do what's right. He only seems to be concerned about what benefit is it to me? What's it going to get me? You know, I don't mind doing it if it's out of what I can do. It's out of my excess. It's not going to hurt me. Do we know people like that? Are we people like that sometimes? Is it easy for us to do things out of our excess? It's easy for me to help somebody. It's easy for me to do things for people when it's really not going out of my way. It's really not hurting me to do this. Do we give, whether locally or to missions or to people in need, when it really doesn't hurt me? Oh yeah, you know, I gave X number of dollars to something, and you know what? Doesn't mean I'm not going to just eat as well as I always eat and do the things that I always do. Are we sometimes guilty of that as well? Here, I think this Redeemer, that was characteristic of him. The little that we know of him seems that he's concerned about himself and not anyone else. But that's not the case with Boaz. Boaz is willing to do it. You know, I think it's wrong for us to put too much emphasis on just the relationship. It's easy for us to go that way, especially in our culture today, to read a story like Ruth and Boaz and just see the romance in it. I don't think anything that we've seen in this book tells us that there's romance is what's driving all of this. Boaz is an older man. He's doing what is right. Doesn't mean that he doesn't care, but what's driving him is knowing what is right to do. What is the right thing to do is to care and provide, and that's what he wants to do here. He wants to do what's right. And so we see in the text when he says, I cannot do it. I can't redeem it for myself. And you know, we know from this, it's not that he can't do it. It's that he doesn't want to do it. I can't do it because it's going to impair my inheritance. Not, you know, he should have just said, I just don't want to do it because it's going to hurt me financially. I can't help but read that and get convicted of myself sometimes, of those times when I choose to not do something because it might inconvenience me for a day, or it might inconvenience me for a couple of weeks, or it's just, I just don't feel like doing it. I don't want to be that. I don't want to be the unknown guy that this man is. And so he says, take my right of redemption for yourself, for I cannot redeem it. And then in verse 7 and 8, we see a custom showing a confirmation, a transaction there. It's kind of thrown in here out of nowhere. Now, this was a custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging to confirm a transaction. The one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other, as this was the manner of a testing in Israel. So when the redeemer said to Boaz, "Buy it for yourself," he drew off his sandal and he gave it to him. So apparently this was a custom prior to the time of the writing of the book of Ruth, that if I were making a transaction of land, that I would take my sandal off and I would give it to you. I would hand it to you. The idea, the picture behind that is the land that you would walk on. It showed the connection that I possess this land, I own this land that I tread upon, and now I'm going to take the sandal off that has been walking on this land and I give it to you. And it shows that we're actually doing this transaction. Today, what would make a handshake might be that same thing. But we shook hands on it, you know? That's kind of saying, I agree. Taking off the sandal does the same thing. And I think the author's probably saying that, giving us the clue that when he takes off that sandal, he wants us to know that it has to do with this custom of confirming a transaction. Because in the law, there was another time when a sandal would be taken off and handed to somebody. And that was in this scenario of redeeming a widow. Back in Deuteronomy 25, where I read, if the brother dwells together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead shall not be married outside the family to a stranger, but her husband's brother will go in and take her as his wife. And the text continues on, if the man does not wish to take the brother's wife, then the brother's wife shall go to the gate of the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of the city shall call him back and speak to him. And if he persists, saying, I do not wish to take her, then the brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders and pull off his sandal of his foot and spit in his face. Kind of graphic. Why? Because they're recognizing that what he's doing, or in this case, what he chooses not to do, is shameful. He's not doing what is right. He's not doing what is expected. It's not just he's not doing what the law says. This is where the law is personal. This is where he's not doing what's right to care for the widow. And so they would take the sandal off. In this case, the widow would take the sandal off and spit in his face. But yet here in Ruth, I don't think that's the reason why he's taken. I don't think the man is saying, hey, you know, I know I'm disgraceful. Here's my sandal, you know, waiting to be spit on. I think what we're seeing here is that he's just confirming this transaction. But one can't help but think this is also the man who probably should have his sandal taken off and spit in his face, because he is being shameful. He is choosing what's best for him rather than what the right thing is to do. So the transaction is being completed here. And Boaz finishes this. Remember, he called the elders together. But what we find here from the text is not only are these 10 elders there with him, but other people have begun to listen in. There's people of the city that are gathering around. Not unusual when, you know, if things are transactions that might be sounding kind of interesting, you might get people listening in, seeing what's going on. Hey, there's Boaz. I wonder what's going on here. And so there, people are gathering around. And so in verse 9, Boaz says to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and to Mahlon. And Ruth, the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. He's now wanting them to bear witness to what took place. Yeah, they shook hands on the deal, but now Boaz doing the right thing. He's making sure this is done legally, that it's being done right in the presence of the elders. I want you to witness that this is taking place, that this man is choosing not to do what is right, and that I will step in and I'm going to take this. I'm going to redeem the land. I'm going to redeem the name through Ruth. And what is their answer? In verse 11, then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. And they pronounce a blessing on Boaz. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. And may you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez. He gives us threefold blessing here, which is really, it's one blessing given three different ways, just wording it differently. But you notice that their focus on what the blessing is not about the land. They're not saying, oh, may God just flourish that land and that harvest would be great. Even their blessing is focused on the people. It's focused on the name that's being preserved here. May the Lord make this woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. What does it mean? Okay, who were Rachel and Leah? You go back to the book of Genesis, and you see that Jacob had two wives, Rachel and Leah. And between their two wives, Rachel and Leah, and the two handmaids, all 12 sons of Israel, of the 12 tribes of Israel, were born through them. So the blessing first is that, may this woman, may Ruth be like her. But stop for a minute and think about, do you realize what they're saying? These are women and people of Israel saying, may this woman, this foreigner, this Moabite, may she be blessed. May the Lord make her who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah. May she continue this line of Israel. The second part of the blessing, may you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. Boaz, may you be found worthy. May you be, there's an idea of wealth. May you be found, you become wealthy from this. May God bless you monetarily. But he's also, may you be renowned in Ephrathah. Ephrathah, that the meaning of that is fruitful. But may your name be found great in Ephrathah. And that's so prophetic because as we'll see next week as we finish the book, that it's through the line of Boaz and Ruth that who comes? That King David comes through that line. And then ultimately Jesus Christ comes through that line. And you remember, anyone, when you hear that word Ephrathah, we saw it back at the beginning in chapter 1 where it said that they were Ephrathites. And here, may you act worthily in Ephrathah. Did that name, do you think, I've heard that name before. Where else have I heard Scripture talk about that? And then you turn to Micah chapter 5, verse 2. It says, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are little among the clans of Judah, it's through you that the Christ would come. And part of their blessing is that Ephrathah would be renowned through Boaz and through what Boaz is doing. And then the third part of it is that may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. So we have more history. Go back to Genesis chapter 38 and we see the story of that. We had Jacob with Rachel and Leah had 12 tribes. The fourth son was Judah. And Judah and Tamar gave birth to Perez. And what we find as we read through the rest of the genealogy is that Perez is the one that's the ancestor of this region. Perez is the ancestor of Bethlehemites, of Ephrathites. And so may your house be like that of Perez. There's also so much common connection between the life and what took place with Tamar and Judah. We don't really have time to explore that, but I recommend go back and read that because there's a lot of similar things going on. This Levirate marriage, we only see it besides the declaration of it in the law, there's only two places where we see it actually taking place. One is here in Ruth, and the other is in Genesis chapter 38. We also, there's some connection there because just as Ruth was a foreigner, so was Tamar. And so the blessing is about the name. The blessing is about continuing the name of the clan of Elimelech in the land of Bethlehem. And yet, and I'll close with this connection here, two quick points. First, the Redeemer that we've seen, the one that really isn't acting worthy. What was required or what was necessary for a Redeemer to do what he needed to do? There were three things that we saw in it. First of all, he had to be a relative. This near relative was the one that the Boaz goes to. He has to be a relative. Secondly, he needs to be able to redeem either the land or the person. Was this person able to? Yeah, he had the means to do it. But thirdly, he needed to be willing to do it. And there's such a prophetic or theological connection to that. Remember, Jared talks about when we look back in the Old Testament, there's those three things we need to look at of the history of what's going on. We also see how God is working with his people. And the third thing is we need to step back and how do we see Jesus in this passage here? And I think we see him as not the Redeemer who's not even worthy to have his name mentioned. But he's the Redeemer like Boaz. He's the greater Redeemer. He's the one, Jesus is the one who is a relative of us. In Hebrews chapter 2, it tells us that the reason that Jesus became one of us, became a man, was so that he could redeem us. Speaking of Jesus, the author of Hebrews says, "Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself, Jesus, likewise partook of the same things that through death he might destroy the one who has power of death, that is the devil." And later on he says, "Therefore he, Jesus, had to be made like his brothers in every respect." He had to become a man so that he could redeem man. So he fulfilled that first part of the Redeemer, that he's like us, he's one of us. Secondly, he has to be able to redeem us. Was Jesus able to redeem us? Yes. He was able to redeem us from our sin. And in fact, nobody else could. He was the only one. In the same way that Boaz said, "If you're not going to do it, I will, because there's no one else." In the case of Jesus redeeming us from our sins, he is the only one. Because places like 2 Corinthians 5:21 says, "He who knew no sin." So he was able to redeem us because he wasn't guilty in the same way that we are of sin. But number three, just as important, not that he was just one of us, not that he was able to, but Jesus was willing to. He laid down his life for us. He says it himself in the Gospels, and the epistles testify it as well. Jesus willingly gave his life. He was willing to do all that was necessary. In our text, we see Boaz was willing to do what was necessary. Even at personal cost, he would be willing to do it, unlike this close Redeemer who wouldn't be. And last thought, if Hector, if you get in the team, want to make your way up here. I can't read a text like this without also seeing the personal connection to that. What does my name mean? Do people look at me like they look at the no-name Redeemer? If people at work, people at school, when people hear the name Lee Boswell, John Sapp, whoever it might be, when people hear your name, what comes to mind? Are you going to end up being just Mr. or Mrs. so-and-so? Or do you reflect the character and the quality the godliness of the people that we've seen here, of Ruth and Boaz. To do the right thing, not for the sake of doing the right thing. But we've seen in this text that it's not just obedience that drove Boaz and Ruth. It was that they knew that God was the one in control, and it was God that they served. Their obedience came out of love of God. Their obedience came out of service to God because of what God has done in their life. Do we do that too? Are we known as people who serve others, who give, who are willing to do anything that's necessary because it's the right thing to do because of what Christ did for us? He did the right thing. You know, at the beginning of the message, we're supposed to give the C note. What is the main thought for you to listen throughout the message and get? I didn't give that. Let me give it to you now. A worthy name is the result of righteous obedience that reflects faith in a sovereign God. That's what I saw in this text. A worthy name is the result of righteous obedience that reflects faith in a sovereign God. Is that what drives you? That's what drove Boaz. Belief and faith in a sovereign God. And from it, his name, he's the one remembered. We turn to this book and we see the name Boaz. We don't see the name of this unnamed Redeemer instead. I hope for me, I hope for you, that what's driving you, what's making a name for yourself, is not for our own glory, our own being lifted up, but for the glory of Christ. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for this word. Thank you for a story that is not just a story to make this part of the book interesting in the midst of other passages that are going on. Father, you gave us this message, this story of Ruth and Boaz, for a reason. You gave it to us so that we would see the connection that ultimately leads to the coming of your Son to redeem us as the Messiah. But Father, you also gave it to us for us to see you working in people's lives, directing through your providence for your will. And Father, we have seen examples of godly men and women who desire to give glory to you. Father, I pray that in response, we would do the same. Father, you and you alone are worthy of glory and honor and praise. May our obedience to you be not out of simple obligation, but may our obedience to you be out of love. May that drive us. Father, may we in our workplaces, in our homes, in our schools, wherever we might be, may we ultimately be lifting up the one name that really does matter, the name of Jesus. May we perpetuate that in our lives and through our lives.